of the church and for your soul as well. Pastors are succumbing to the spirit of it. People are succumbing. Don't you succumb. I want to urge you to get a copy of my book, Renewing the Soul of America. As we're looking here at a period of patriotic days coming up here, important in the history of our country, you need to equip yourself with this information. Pastors have used this book all across the country, over 650 endnotes. It is an absolute wealth of information, Renewing the Soul of America. It's a $17 book, but for your gift of $12 or more to Save America Ministries, we want to put it in your hands. Just call us, 1-800-SAVE-USA. Get it on our website, saveus.org. Renewing the Soul of America, one person at a time, beginning with you. It's going to set forth the vision, the godly vision for us. Let's walk in it. God bless you. Be a blessing. And remember, get Renewing the Soul of America and pray for our nation, friends. We may fulfill God's holy purpose.
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Crismeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners. Let me urge you to become a partner with Chuck as a voice to the church declaring vision for the nation. Join us again next time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.
The views expressed on this program are those of the hosts and guests and are not necessarily those of IRN, its advertisers, or affiliates.
This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, hopefully now everything is going fine and running smoothly, because we're coming to you from the hills overlooking a beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, and hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, of course, for the next hour, they're going to be those of Bob Chapman from the International Forecaster. And, Bob, how are you tonight?
Not bad at all. I'm pretty good.
All right, fine. Well, as we get a little older, we're not quite as good as we were a few years ago, but Bob Chapman certainly has a very, very excellent appraisal of what's going on in the financial world today. And ladies and gentlemen, these are some of the most exciting, dangerous, frightening, economic times of our lives. It was last week where we saw oil get up to, well, I guess what was about $1.36 a barrel, something like that. It's backed off since then. We've seen gold and silver move up strongly and then back off a little bit. But, of course, what most people do not really understand is that we are in the middle of a total upheaval of our economic system that may well destroy the value of our currency, which, of course, always leads to chaos in a country. So pick the story up from there, Bob.
Well, it's pretty wide-ranging. The credit crisis is not over. And it's not going to be over for a long time. Minimum 3 years. That's a minimum. It's hard to tell. And it could very easily end up in a total financial breakdown. The money that is being raised by financial companies, banks, investment banking firms, brokerage firms, is colossal. And if you put all of those debts together, and which are the product of the subprime and ALTA loan as well as option arm market, you're looking at somewhere between $2 and $3 trillion. Those losses are going to have to be absorbed. In the meantime, we have the Federal Reserve continuing to continue to expand money and credit at a rate presently of around 18%. I saw some figures from an economic company that supposedly did what I do, and they came out with about 15%. I suppose the euro-dollar market is the big difference, so. But anyway, 15% is a lot, and I think my figures are closer than theirs.
And you think you're talking now, what, about 18%? Are you talking about M3?
Yeah, the old M3 that they don't publish anymore because they don't want you to know what you're doing. They are doing, I should say.
And what they're really doing, of course, is massively expanding money and credit in an effort to keep the whole system from collapsing. And that's just the opposite from what they should be doing. They should be trying to save the dollar rather than trying to save the system.
Well, that's correct. And I said that when they made the move to go one way or the other, and, of course, they saved themselves. They don't care about the system.
Hold that. We'll be back in just a moment here with Bob Chapman. Okay, Bob, but go ahead and pick the story. And you're just saying basically that the Federal Reserve System, instead of doing what they're supposed to do and save our currency, they wanted to save the financial system and all their friends in the banking and finance industry. And as a result, certainly the dollar, as we know it, is doomed and will lose, I think, the majority of the rest of its value. And, of course, when other countries in the world recognize that, otherwise they'll want to divest themselves of dollars, and soon it'll be a competitive issue. Who can get out of the dollar first? And heaven help us when all those dollars we've transferred to other countries throughout the years, so we wouldn't have inflation and they would. When they come cascading home, why, we're going to be in real trouble.
And that has to happen sooner or later. I mean, these countries, they just can't keep on absorbing these dollars. It's just impossible. You know, it can't be done indefinitely. You know, where the breaking point is, I don't know. I don't think anybody knows, but it's going to come. And it's the same thing with the increases in M3, money and credit. They're going to be able to try to hold off this avalanche of debt replacement. And they do that by creating more money and credit to offset it. But they'll reach a point where business and speculators will say, I really don't want to borrow any more money. And when that day comes, deflation will take over no matter what they do in the way of increasing and creating money and credit. So there'll come a time here, and I figure a few years, that they won't be able to hold on anymore. It's very, very difficult. you know, to put a timeline in this thing, all you can say is it's not going to be long, but it's not going to be short. It'll probably be in that time frame. But things do happen that you can't control. A good example was the bank analyst at Oppenheimer and Company, Meredith Whitney, who came out and said in June that what Citibank had been carrying on its books at what they were carrying, and that wasn't worth it. And that brought on this credit crisis and the declaration of all this debt with lots and lots to follow. You know, Meredith came out yesterday and said she thinks it's a 2.5 to 3 year proposition minimum for them to clean up their books.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment.
People
here.
The truth.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Bob Chapman, and of course he's just talking about what's going on in the world. He mentioned Meredith Wilson, who of course is a financial analyst, had just come out yesterday and said it's going to be another 2 to 3 years before suddenly the banks begin to get their financial affairs straightened out. We know that Citigroup, the largest bank in the United States, is in real trouble, having to frantically trying to raise money just so that they can keep their doors open. Because certainly Citigroup, even though it is very, very large, some people say it's too large to fail, we couldn't let it fail, we'll do everything we can to try to preserve it, it still has an awful lot of problems. Certainly United Bank of Switzerland, the third largest bank in the entire world, and with branches here in the United States, but Union Bank of Switzerland has already written off something like $38 billion, and has another $72 billion there in questionable loans. They've already sold part of themselves to the Arabs and others to try to raise funds. Now they're raising another $15 billion in stock options, or in stocks from the people who already own their stock. But all the banks are desperate for funds now because, of course, they have all these bad debts. And then, of course, we have the credit card companies that are holding so much, you know, in the way of debt from the people, and a lot of people just cannot pay it back, especially when they're paying up a 30%, 25 to 30% interest. And, of course, they make their payments every month and not paying on the principal, they're just paying off the interest. And so we've created a situation where many people will literally never be able to get out of debt. Go right ahead, Bob.
Well, you covered a lot of ground there. I think that one of the things that solidifies my belief in the fact that this problem is nowhere near an end is when they troop out all these people from Wall Street and Washington and say, 75% of the credit crisis is over, 50% is over, or it's all over. When I hear things like that, I know they're grasping at straws. If I had to guess, I would say it was 25% over, and maybe less than that. And so we've got a long way to go. This is going to affect a lot of companies that people never would have thought would have a problem. And the reason they are having a problem is they bought bonds that held mortgages or loans, and they were supposedly AAA, and of course they're not. They were BBB, which is the difference between a 10 and a 4. And yesterday Moody's came out and said, well, the reason that we misquoted the rating for all of this toxic garbage, as it's now called, was because we had a glitch in our computer. But I thought it was interesting that S&P and Fitch, when those ratings were made 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago, they all came up with the same ratings. And they would have had to have done the same thing that Moody's did Did they have a glitch too? No, I don't think so. Moody's is lying. And because they know there's going to be lots and lots of lawsuits. And a number of companies should go under in that respect. And then you've got the long daisy chain of the Federal Reserve, the Lenda, the Raiders, who we just talked about, the mortgage originators, the appraisers, the salespeople, and the borrowers, all of whom committed fraud. And, yeah, we see the FBI pursuing 1,500, 2,000 of these people who broke the law. But none of them are in any investment banking houses or banks. Well, they're not going after the public in general. They're going after the mortgage originators because that's safe for them to do because they're not members of the Illuminati. And so nothing's going to get done. And they're going to come up with legislation eventually, which is going to cost the American taxpayer probably $1 trillion when all is said and done. And if Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac go under, which I think they will, the figure could be $2 or $3 trillion. I mean, the losses that are being faced by the American people because of Congress and our president and the banking industry and Wall Street are colossal. I mean, there's no way they can ever be paid. And I think that is eventually going to lead to the collapse of the dollar. Now, the dollar is down from 120 here in the last few years versus the USDX, which is a index which is made up of six major currencies from other countries on a weighted basis. And that's trading around 72 right now. And I think it could go to 40 pretty easily. Maybe 50 to 55, but I think things are going to unfold in a pretty nasty way. And so I see those kinds of figures becoming reality. Another thing, too, is that the American public is so in debt that they can't continue to purchase the way that they have. I don't think they can get a heck of a lot more credit. Being able to cash out in a home is far, far more difficult than before. It's extremely difficult now to get an equity line loan. And they're sitting there with $10,000 on their credit cards and myriad other loans, and they're not in a position to continue to consume the way they have in the past. So if you drop from 70 to 71% of GDP being made up of the American consumer, and it drops down, say, I saw a report today, they were talking 67. These are economists. And I said, that's all well and good. But the long-term mean in the last 25 years is 64.5%. And if you go back longer than that, it's 63%. So if we drop from 70 to 72% down to the long-term mean of 64.5%, you're going to have a lollapalooza of a recession on your hands.
Well, of course, the thing is that where the people are getting into a squeeze is because the price of oil and food and airline tickets and diesel and gasoline is going up. And, of course, so things are certainly costing them more. And then, of course, the value of their dollar is going down. So anything that is imported from other countries, and today most of our things really are imported from other countries, then the price of those goes up as well. And then, of course, you know, the price of electricity has gone up considerably. So people are going to have real difficulty, you know, maintaining their living standards. Certainly, you know, heating oil has doubled in cost. Propane has doubled or almost tripled in cost if you have a home where you use propane as we do. So basically, a lot of people are really going to be hurting. They're just not going to have the money to spend as they have in the past.
And that says it all. And that's where we're headed. And that's why it was so important. I've been on this program probably about 10 years. And we've been talking about elimination of debt, particularly credit card and revolving debt, automobile vehicle debt, and getting a financial house in order, which a lot of people have done, and picking up freeze-dried and dehydrated food and something to defend your family, filter for water. I mean, those are all basic insurance policies. And you should have been doing that over the last 8 or 10 years. And hopefully you have. And then if you have extra money, you go into gold and silver-related assets. And that should, you know, complete the package for most people, the things that need to be done. But if you think about what we're talking about here, and if we're correct, which I believe we are, and as Stan knows, over the last 10 years, my forecasts have been unbelievable. I don't know that anybody has ever had the luck that I've had in coming up with the events and the investments and so on and so forth. It's just been absolutely incredible, and I'm happy for the subscribers and listeners in particular who have followed my advice. But this is what you've got to do. This is important. It's not too late to get out of that debt, and you've got to do it. And I know it's even more difficult now than it was 2 or 3 years ago, just like Stan just explained. But you got to do it.
Well, you know, really what's happening is, of course, the credit card interest rate has gone up astronomically. I was down at Sears the other day buying a little something. The fellow said, look, you can get $15 off your credit if you just get one of our cards. I said, gee, that's a pretty good deal. He says, sign here. And I looked at it, and they're talking about 25%, 27%, 29%. I didn't figure out what all those things were for, but I knew they were going to charge me an awful lot of interest. And I just said, thanks very much. I think I'll just pay cash. And, of course, they're desperately trying to get people to take out credit cards. But if you take out a credit card and you miss a payment, you're looking at already a 29 or 30% interest rate. And this is devastating. We used to call it usury. And it should be outlawed, but, of course, it's not, because the people who are providing the money control the government. And what a better way to enslave people than to get them so deeply in debt they will never be able to get out. And this is really what's happening, but it's creating problems for the financial institutions as well, because some people are just saying, we're not going to pay it. And then what happens? Well, we're going to be back in just a moment with Bob Chapman discussing what's going on in our country financially. Go right ahead, Bob.
Well, I think the next crisis is going to be in that credit card market. And I continue to see all of these percentage of holdings in credit cards and other kinds of revolving credit. And also, the figures are worsening and will for some time to come in the subprime, Alta, and option arm areas. I just wrote something this evening. I mean, the figures are just astronomical. I mean, on the equity loans, I just was floored. I just got the figures in. Listen to this. Delinquencies for home equity lines of credit were 7.22% of the current aggregate pool balances for the 2007 vintage. Those are lines that were taken advantage of and executed during 2007. There are also some delinquencies, serious delinquencies for 2005 and 2006. The subprime delinquency rate rose to, you won't believe this, 25.87%, up 6 points from the previous report, and the Alta rate is 25.87%, and the trends are accelerating. I mean, that's incredible. But to me, it's not. Because I predicted that 50% of all subprime and ALTA loans, this is 3 years ago, would go upside down. And when all is said and done, that's what we're going to end up with.
Well, that means an awful lot of people then are going to have their houses foreclosed on. And do you have any idea how many houses have been foreclosed at the present time? I know there are an awful lot of them last year and the first quarter of this year.
I don't know. I don't have those figures available. I do so many numbers here in this report. I can't remember them all. I'm glad this was sitting in front of me so I could read it to you to show you the gravity of the situation.
Well, the figure I've heard is actually about 1.6 million were foreclosed on last year, over 600,000 the first quarter of this year, and heaven only knows how many there'll be in the second quarter. But these are homes that I certainly were foreclosed on and then had to be put up for sale.
Well, that's why they, Congress, being political animals, that's why Congress is saying, oh, we got to bail these people out. Number one, they're bailing the banks out. Number two, some of the borrowers will be bailed out as well. And you get to pay for it out there. You American taxpayers who have paid your bills, you haven't made loans that you shouldn't have made. You didn't lie on your application. You did what you were supposed to do. And now you, because of your Congress, get to pay for all of those people who shouldn't have loans, who lied about their loans. And all the others who partook in that, which were all the people I named all the way up the line.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course Bob was just saying that the American taxpayer is going to be stuck with a lot of these loans that the people never should have gotten, and of course Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are doing everything they can to provide loans to people who have gotten into trouble through the conventional loan system. But the trouble is, of course, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are backed by the taxpayer, and of course if those loans start to go bad, in other words if people transfer from the conventional loan into a federal loan or federal back loan or FHA loan, if those loans go down, then the whole economic system goes down. It's pretty well what it's going to come up with. And the American taxpayers are going to just see the value of their currency decline. They're going to have to be more and more in the way of taxes, a dilution of the value of our currency. And pretty soon, why we could be heading towards the way they did in the Weimar Republic, or is it doing in Zimbabwe today, where they have something like, 15,000% interest, a month.
They just have no choice.
Right. Well, all we can really do is, of course, watch these things unfold and realize that I believe there's a method in their madness. I don't think it's really happening by accident. I really think that they do want to destroy the value of the currency and take us into a gold-backed currency which they will control. And I think it's only a matter of time before the American people suddenly realize that we've been had, and that everything they've worked their whole life for, their pension funds, their insurance policies, their annuities, they thought that we're going to give them security, and there's not going to be any security there at all. Anything tied to the American dollar, of course, will certainly lose its value and lose it very, very rapidly.
Well, that brings us around to the only safe place for money, and that's in gold and silver-related assets.
Well, what happened this last week? We saw gold make an excellent recovery, and then they went up to 930, then they knocked it back down again.
Well, the government is in the market, and gold is making its way up. Don't forget, it just came from 845 intraday, and it traded at 935 today. At the end of the day at 918.10 off 950, and silver was 1792 down 6 cents. But it can't go up every day either. There are traders and there is profit taking. I think yesterday we saw short covering in a big way, and there were still major short positions out there among commercials, which are professionals. And I think at the rate that this is going right now, if we can come back next week and move up to, say, 950-60, I think you're going to have a breakout on one of the most important stocks in the producing area, which is Agnico Eagle, which it closed today around $70 a share. It had a high of 82 not too long ago. I think, and that 82 was a 1033 on gold. Now, mind you, I've been doing this for almost 50 years. And I certainly know that company upside down. We started buying it at $4, and I've never recommended a sell on it. And I believe that when gold is 950-60, that Agnico will break out to a new high. And when that happens, it'll take the gold price and everything else with it. I think that's going to be the key. And there are, you know, all the stocks will move, generally speaking, in the gold and silver area. The exploration stocks only move when something positive is going on the company. But the first and second tier of gold and silver shares should do quite well. And that's what I'm expecting before the summer is out. And I think we'll go through 1033 like it wasn't there. And I think we're headed somewhere between $1,200 an ounce and $1,650 an ounce by the end of the year. And it could even go higher. It all depends on what transpires. We have all of this political stuff going on because there's a presidential election coming, and we don't know who's going to be president, but the three major participants, all are controlled by the same people from behind the scenes, so it doesn't matter who you get. And the media has made Ron Paul the only viable candidate, a non-person. But I still think he's got a shot at doing this.
And well, hold that thought. When we get back here, we welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Our guest is Bob Chapman. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, our guest is Bob Chapman. We're just talking about what's happening to gold and silver. Bob was saying that certainly there's a lot of uncertainties this year because of the elections coming up, but it really doesn't matter because all three of the major candidates, that is McCain, Obama, and Clinton, they're all controlled by the Illuminati, or at least certainly to call it the Illuminati, call it the establishment, call it the Brotherhood of Darkness, which I do, doesn't matter. There is an elite that runs our country, and they run candidates in both the Democrat and Republican Party tickets, and then, of course, whichever side wins, their candidate always wins. So go right ahead.
I think that were things to stay the same as they look right now, then we would have another one of their control personalities as president. And I think that that would be accompanied over the next 2 or 3 years by a total collapse in the world economy, never mind the United States. Because the U.S. goes down the tubes, everybody's going with them. And anybody that thinks that Europe and Canada and Mexico and the third world countries, like even Brazil, which is doing very well, and Russia, they're all going to suffer. There's no question. And so, where do you want to be? You want to be in the only asset that owes nobody anything, and that's gold, in the final analysis. And you're going to find that, in fact, on silver, I did a projection this evening, And I believe that that a $100 silver, which I think is very doable, a junk silver dime, those are pre-64 dimes, would be worth $7.15. And that's without a premium whatsoever. And it could be worth as much as $10. Well, goodness gracious, if you've got a bag that you're going to pay, I don't know, something like $12,000 for right now, it's going to be worth five times that. And so, you know, being in gold and silver is something to strongly think about. And a recommendation in that area has been spot on all the way, as well as with many other things, including our short positions, etc. And the reason I'm telling you things like this is not to pat myself on the back.
Hold that thought, Bob. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Bob Chapman. And right now, of course, before we go on, Bob, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get in touch with the International Forecaster. And if they're interested, subscribe to it.
The Forecaster is about business, finance, economics, and social and political issues all over the world. And we publish by email on Wednesdays and Saturdays. It usually runs around 30 pages. And we have a hard copy for those of you who are not on the Internet. And so if you'd like to get a free introductory copy, you can get it off the site or through the phone number I'll give you. The site address is TheInternationalForecaster.com. The International, FORECASTER.com. If you'd like to email us with a question, we answer everybody. That address is International_Forecaster@Yahoo.com. International_FORECASTER@YAHOO.com. And if you'd like to call toll free, that number is 800-375-4188. 800-375-4188.
All right, fine. Of course, right now we have Randy calling in from Spokane, Washington. Again, our telephone number is 1-888. That's 888-24-LIBERTY. Hi, Randy. How are you doing? You have a question or comment? Randy?
Well, yeah, let's try. I'm sorry about that.
Go right ahead.
Yes, Bob, and I just love you and Pat, your shows, the one on Saturdays here. Tell me the name of it again.
All the Money?
Oh, yeah, the Truth Seekers. That's so good. Oh, Bob gets so wound up. I really love listening to you guys. Okay, the question now. I sold a property. I'm going to get about $50,000 that I can play with. What kind of, last week Pat was talking about the right kind of gold, like Liberties, Saints, stuff like that. Stay away from bullion. Do 80-20 silver. What would you do?
I think you should take the money and split it in half and put half in gold and silver coins and half in stocks.
Stocks?
I think he's talking about gold and silver stocks, Randy.
Really?
Right.
I've been burned up on them in the past. I got burned by penny stocks. But you still think a guy could do okay with those, huh?
Well, what you can do is buy Agnico Eagle, Gold Corp, and Silver Standard. They're all blue chips. And they'll do very well.
If you recommend them, I mean...
That's what I'm recommending to the subscribership. I do have one speculative stock, but that's it. And I've been recommending those stocks for a long, long time, and the speculative one for the last year. I do about one every year, and that's it. And with the coins, I would spec in this market right now, I would go 80-20, and I would go 20% in silver, and I would use the bags because of the premium on the Silver Eagles.
Right.
And the rest of it, I would split... perhaps 30% in bullion coins and 50% of the remainder in numismatic coins. Then you get a real good spread.
Sure. Get the eagles and the gold in? I guess that's all you can get, though. Isn't it?
You mean the gold eagles?
Yeah.
Well, there's a number of... Look, you've got to talk to the dealer.
Okay.
And we recommend a couple of people. And incidentally, I don't get any commissions or anything financial from anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I recommend somebody, I am not getting any kickbacks.
Sure.
Just want people to know that. And I do it as a service. I'm interested in people subscribing and doing the right thing for themselves.
And, well, you're helping people. You're the most wise guy on the radio. You and Dr. Stan are so wise. You guys are so full of knowledge.
Well, look how old we are, for goodness sake.
No, that's why you guys are so wise. We appreciate your service. I do, for sure.
Well, I think that Bob will... Well, I appreciate your kind words, Randy. I think that, Sidney, Bob would suggest you talk to your dealer. I think that he actually, in the past, has recommended some collector items, haven't you? So you're probably part in bullion, part in collector. What collector coins would you suggest, Bob?
Well, the only ones that I think that the public should really get involved in, because they're unprofessional in that field, is graded mint state numismatic coins if you're going to get into collectibles.
Right.
And you don't buy a coin for $14,000 that have got a $6,000 markup built into it. You know, you buy an MS64 St. Gaudens that's graded and sealed, and you pay $1,200 or whatever it costs. And incidentally, I bought my first one for $47, I'll have you know.
All right.
And I still have it.
Wow. Which just shows how much our dollar's lost value. Like Ron Paul, when he was in Spokane, 97% of the value of the dollar's gone since 1913.
He's absolutely right. Hey, we're going to have to run because we've got a board full. Thanks very much for calling. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, fine. And now, is this Mark we've got on there? Hello? Hello there? Is anybody there? Well, let's try line three of that. Hello? How about line three? There we are. Washington? So, line... Well, let me get a little over to line two here. Hang on a little, we'll be back in just a moment. All right, go right ahead.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Stan. How you doing? This is Mark.
Okay, fine. Good to have you with us, Mark. And together, our number 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Go right ahead.
Hi, Bob. I hope you're doing well this evening.
Thank you.
Yeah, Bob, I had a question for you. Earlier today, I heard a fellow named Richard Doughty on the Steve Quayle Show. And I don't know if you've heard of him or not, but he said the usual ratio, I guess he's meaning traditionally in history, perhaps even recent history up until these current times, is a ratio of 15-1 when it comes to the value, the spot price, or the general average market value of gold in relationship to silver. That gold generally would be a 15-1 ratio as far as its worth per ounce. And I figured it out, and of course that's not true today as far as the ratio between gold and silver goes on the spot market, but it actually would be at $75 an ounce of that 15-1 ratio, which I assume has traditionally been the average. You would know better than I do, Bob, but so it would be roughly 80% undervalued just as it has been traditionally in relationship to the price of gold.
One of the problems you've got today is you've got a manipulated market.
Mm-hmm.
That manipulation started in 1988 when the executive order was put in place for the working group and financial markets, and it essentially allowed the bankers to do what they want with the market.
What process do they use to do this, Bob? Because they seem to be using that process or processes very effectively in order to suppress the price of especially gold and silver. Excuse me.
You're absolutely right, and the whole thing is manipulated. Hopefully one of these days they'll lose control, and these products can go to their own value. They've manipulated the copper market, the nickel market. They've manipulated these markets for years to keep, of course, the people in the third world country impoverished, and, of course, so that we here in the United States could live a very good life utilizing the the basic products, the natural minerals from the third world countries. But one of these days they're going to lose control of this whole thing, and there's going to be a real supply and demand situation, and that will set the prices rather than the manipulators. What they're doing is illegal, but then who are you going to report them to?
Yeah, that's right. They're right at the top of the pyramid, as I understand.
You know, Mark, I want to say one thing about the ratios and what I was getting at.
Yes.
And this is that in a manipulated market, none of those ratios work. None of the charts work. None of the cycles.
Mm-hmm.
None of the waves. They don't work.
Right.
Because you have these ulterior forces coming in when you don't expect it. Take gold. You know, they just ran it down from 1033 to 845.
Yeah,
and now it's on its way back up again. But they've accomplished what they wanted to do, was to impede progress.
Mm-hmm.
But you, every one of these people in those fields, the ones that use ratios and charts, etc., every time they call for a correction, they've been dead wrong. We just had this correction, and we get to 850. They all said it was going to 700, 600, 200. And
I didn't know that.
Back up again almost $100.
Yeah.
And so you say to yourself, then is it working? So, look, you look at the fundamentals. That's all you want to be interested in.
Well, very enlightening, and I certainly appreciate all the good information, gentlemen. Y'all have a good night. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. That was Mark calling from Florence, Oregon. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Our guest is Bob Chapman. We're talking about how the stock market is manipulated, how the commodity market is manipulated, how gold and silver are manipulated, and, of course, what can you do to protect yourself? And, of course, when you're in an inflationary spiral, as we are today, and there's an article I just got today, actually came from a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, who was talking about the existence of inflation, about 12%, and about the M3, which he had quoted as 17%. Bob says it's 18%. But that represents where inflation will be. What would you say, 6 months or a year from now? What does the M3 really represent?
It represents money within the system, and it usually shows up 6 months to a year later.
Inflation.
What you can count on is inflation staying at the same rate or higher for 6 months to a year. And I believe that if they keep that M3, which is the figure it used to be known by, if they keep that around 18%, you're going to have 15% inflation before the year is out. And of course, the government's not going to admit to that, although they're under tremendous flack right now, finally, after myself and only a couple of other people yelling about it for years. People are saying within the establishment, your figure's a phony. And so they're going to have to do something. I don't know what it is. They'll have to tell the truth.
That'll be a very strange day in Hades. Let's go to Dave, who's calling in from Idaho. What part of Idaho are you calling from, Dave?
The Coeur d'Alene area.
Okay, good to have you with us. Do you have a question or comment?
Hi, good evening. I had a question.
Speak up just a little louder.
Sure. When you price gold in the world, is it priced the same in every country? And that was my first question. My second one is a follow-up question. If the credit card debt, if people can't pay that, and because it's unsecured debt, how would that impact the family then?
All right, fine. So first of all, Kit, you want to take the first one. Is gold pretty much the same price all throughout the world?
No. It's different in every currency. And 3.5 to 4 years ago, all the other currencies other than the dollar had gold break out against those currencies. And so gold has been going up against all currencies. And that's all of them. And, of course, the dollar is leading the pack to the downside and followed by other, you know, semi-weak currencies. So it costs, even though gold is traded in dollars internationally, it's still, you have to convert it to the local currency. Like if you live in Germany, you convert it into euros to see what you're going to pay. And gold has appreciated against euros, and not just gold. So it's different in every country.
Dave, if I could suggest, if you go to kitco.com, KITKO, KITCO.com,
okay.
Which I do first thing in the morning, and you look on the left-hand side of the page, at the top they have the price of gold in the United States. If you go down, you come to the price of gold in London, and you go down a little further, you come to the price of gold in Dubai, which is another major gold market, and it's usually much higher in Dubai than it is in the United States. So that will tell you really what's going to happen in a couple of days from now. And of course, this morning in Dubai, gold was, I think, up as high as 939. In other words, some people actually bought it at that price. So that certainly bodes well for gold.
Gotcha. Okay, and then also the question then on the credit card debt. So a normal family, a few years go by, the economy's taking a dump, and they still have unsecured credit card debt. What will be the response from the banks on unsecured credit card debt?
Well, they'd want you to pay it, and if you don't, then they would pursue you in court, and they would get a judgment against you. And that judgment would be laid upon any assets that you had.
I think one of the interesting things is there are companies, and there's one that we're working with, that will actually negotiate with the credit card companies. And many times, you know, if you have a credit, a debt of over maybe $10,000, the credit card company will take 40 or 50 or even, with 40 cents on the dollar or 50 cents on the dollar, just to get it all, you know, to get rid of that debt, to get something back. So I think we're having an interview with this fellow from this group next week. But if you go with this one or some other one, they will very often negotiate with you. They're desperate to get their money back, to get something back. Because remember, they have lent you money that they created out of nothing. So they'd rather get something than nothing. And you can cut back dramatically on your credit card debt if you get somebody who's a professional to negotiate with them for you.
Okay, good. Well, thank you again, gentlemen. I appreciate your show.
God bless, and thanks very much. And,
bye-bye now.
I'm sure you're acquainted with that technique, aren't you, Bob?
Yes, I am.
Those people
and it does work. It does work.
Right, but you've got to have somebody who knows what they're doing. And of course, the banks, this is one of the greatest scams in the world. Banks actually only have to keep 8 to 10% in reserves, and then they create money out of nothing, and then they lend it to you at 30% interest. Boy, that's the greatest scam in the world. And the average individual doesn't understand that in a fiat money system, the sky's the limit. That's the sky's limit for the bank and the bankers. Well, of course, our guest this evening has been Bob Chapman from the International Forecaster. Once again, Bob, do you want to get the telephone number out there where people can reach you?
800-375-4188. 800-375-4188.
All right, you hang on there. We've got Rick calling in from Texas. And hi, Rick. How are you doing?
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing fine. Do you have a question for Bob?
Well, just he's talking about silver. Said dimes could be $7 when it goes up to 100. When does he think that could be? I mean,
hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment and wrap up tonight's program right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We got Rick calling from Texas. And of course, Bob had made a remark about he thought that a dime, a silver dime, 90% silver dime, down the line could actually go up to $7 or maybe even $10 in value. And the question was, when do you think it's going to happen, Bob?
Well, it'll happen in increments. It's not going to do it all at once, that's for sure. And the next drop will be $25 to $30 an ounce. And then you go back to the old high of $45.50. And I'm sure that there will be speculators who will be sellers there. But I think what you've got to look for is $2,268 gold, which would reflect official inflation since 1980 when gold was at $850 an ounce. That's what gold should be trading right now. And we're trading there without the suppression process that has been brought upon us by the manipulators within our government. Silver would be $100 at that level as well. And so I think that's the benchmark as far as I'm concerned. And the government's not going to get away, along with Wall Street, to continue telling people that inflation's 3.9%, down from 4.5% when it's 12.62%. And core inflation means absolutely nothing because it doesn't include food and energy. I mean, I never heard of anything so absurd in my life.
Okay, fine. Rick, does that answer your question? I mean, it's a matter of time. We have no idea when it's going to happen. All we can do is watch and wait and observe what's happening.
Yeah, that answered it. I just wonder if the dollar is going to be useless and gold and silver are still going to be down around 1,020. I mean, 1,000 for gold and 20 for silver. I just wonder how much control they have over the thing. It seems unbelievable how they can manipulate it.
Well, you know, Ben Steele made a speech at a hard money conference in New York, and what he was doing speaking there I'll never know, because to Stan, this is the guy that's on loan from the Royal Institute, Royal Society in London, to the Council on Foreign Relations. He's been at the CFR since 1994, and he's the one who has laid out all the plans for the North American Union. So this guy last weekend was speaking there, and in the next issue there'll be a link to his speech, but he's talking about a gold-backed currency. I was floored. And so that means in the final analysis, the United States is going to have to go back to a gold-backed currency, and if they do, so won't everybody else.
Hey, we're out of time.
Goodness knows where gold is going to go.
Okay, thanks for that very much, Rick.
Thank you.
Very much, Bob. We'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we hope you enjoy our programs. Now, if you haven't heard my talk on the financial tsunami, I recommend it. It's available on DVD or on video. And then there's a syllabus that goes with that, which will give you an idea how to begin to approach the jargon you're going to get out of the Federal Reserve System, which is designed specifically to confuse you. But, of course, you need to know where you can go on the Federal Reserve a site to get the various figures, and then, of course, listening to Bob, will give you great background of what's going on. Of course, our interviews with Patrick Wood are excellent. And Bob was just talking about this fellow named Steele, who had given a talk, a hard money talk. He is, of course, a fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations on loan from the Royal Institute of International Affairs. And that's the gentleman I was just quoting earlier in the program, who said that the inflation rate was up to close to 12%, and the M3 was 17%. And, of course, he is recommending and saying that we are probably going to go back. We're going to have to go back to a currency with value, a gold-backed currency, which will be issued privately by the gold banks. And what he's really talking about is the exchange-traded funds. You have to understand what's going on if you're going to survive. So you start with my talk on the financial tsunami and get the syllabus. Then, of course, you get the book, Creature from Jekyll Island by Ed Griffin. Certainly it's the classic book on what's going on. Then you get the book, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, and the book, The Fiat Money Inflation in France. And if you read those, why, you'll know more than certainly most college professors who are teaching economics, and you'll know what's really going on, not, of course, what is being programmed into our people or the Keynesian concepts, but the reality of what's really happening in the financial markets. Then, of course, we have two little pamphlets. One is called The History of Money. The other is called Financial Meltdown, and we recommend both of them. They're really compilations of our newsletters. You can actually go up on our website and pull down those newsletters, but this makes it much easier for you simply to sit down to read them and underline them in yellow and really understand what has happened in ancient Greece and ancient Rome and in Florence and in Venice and so many other places where they've tried a fiat money system, and it creates great prosperity for a time. And that, of course, the whole system comes cascading down as it is today. So again, the pamphlets, the history of money, and the second one, the financial meltdown. Of course, then we could understand the spiritual forces. You need my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and the DVD. You can get either one or both of them together in the Brotherhood of Darkness special. You need, of course, the talk on the forbidden secret, and of course that comes with a syllabus. You need the talk on the planned police state. It comes with a syllabus. And you really need to understand who is behind this and the spirits of forces that control our economic system. And there really are spirits of forces that are there. How do we know? Because they brag about it. They actually brag about what they're doing. If I could suggest a couple of excellent DVDs that we have nothing to do with other than we appear in them for short segments. One of them is called The Secret Mystery of America's Beginnings, and of course traces everything going on in America back to what happened in Elizabethan England back at the beginning of the 1600s. That's The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning. And then, of course, the second in the series, Riddles in Stone, The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital. And you must understand the occult forces that were here at the time when America was created. Yes, America was created primarily by Christians, but the occult forces were here. Originally, the Christians were predominant. Today, the occultists are predominant, and they control both political parties and the financial and educational system in America, and they control our mass media, and they're moving us towards a one-world government and a new world order, and using the financial and military power of the United States to advance their goal. Our telephone number again is 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, radioliberty.com. Radioliberty.com. Please pray for America, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you of the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and the views of, well, for the next hour, the views of William Federer is certainly one of our favorite guests, and we always look forward to having him with us. Hi, Bill. How are you doing?
Oh, Dr. Stan, great to be with you.
Well, why don't you just pick up the story, because I know you've got a fascinating story to relate to our listeners this evening, and I'm looking forward to hearing it as well.
Well, I recently wrote an article for WorldNet Daily, and it's titled Tyranny of the Atheist Minority. And daily we see news reports of atheists being offended at prayers at graduations, offended at prayers at football games, offended at seeing a cross or a Star of David, offended at Christmas carols or patriotic hymns or Christmas trees or menorahs. We hear court cases where they're offended by the Ten Commandments, or they're offended by Under God and the Pledge of Allegiance. We see court cases where they're or offended that a teacher might hint that there may be a creator. Atheists are offended that a soldier said God bless you at a military funeral. They're offended that the Boy Scout oath says do my duty to God and my country, and offended at a cross on a veteran's memorial, like out there at Mount Soledad, San Diego. And when a Christian is offended, the basic teaching is you are supposed to forgive. But these atheists are not taught that way. When they're offended, they protest, intimidate, threaten, and sue to have their views enforced as law. And so we see that there's a transition taking place in America. Excuse me. Now, one of the things I thought was fascinating was looking at the poll numbers. Now, the USA Today, just this past February 25th, 2008, published the results of the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life. This was called the U.S. Religious Landscape Survey. And in this, the USA Today reported that 51% of Americans identify themselves as evangelical or mainline Protestant Christians, 51.3%. 23.9% identify themselves as Catholic. 1.6% are Eastern Orthodox or other Christian. You add all that up, that's about over 75-76%. There's 1.7% of Americans are Mormon, and 1.7% identify themselves as Jewish. And you add all those up, and that's 80.2% of Americans hold to some kind of Judeo-Christian belief. And then you look at the rest of the poll numbers, 0.7% Buddhist, 0.6% Muslim, 0.4% Hindu, 1.2% Unitarian, Universalist, Spiritual New Age, or Native, 0.3% other world religions, and then I have a little tickle in my throat. It goes on down, but only 1.6% of Americans identify themselves as atheists. And I was just amazed to imagine that here we have 1.6% of the population dictating what the laws are going to be for the other, at least the 80.2% that have Judeo-Christian values. And I thought, what do you call it when, you know, 1% forces its will on 80%? I think that's called a tyranny. And we may as well go back to the way it was in America during the colonial times, when the King of England forced his minority views on the rest of the country. And we actually fought a revolution because we wanted the people to be their own rulers, not to have a minority king.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. All right, go right ahead, Bob. Go right ahead, William.
Well, the Declaration of Independence, July 4th, 1776, actually lists in there, it says, the history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having a direct object, the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. A prince, whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant, is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. And so we saw that the King of England was acting as a tyrant, that he was enforcing his minority views. And here today, every day in the news, we see the Democrat primary. We see Hillary and Obama. Well, the Democrat primary in 1936 was won by Franklin D. Roosevelt. And in accepting his party's renomination for president, Franklin Roosevelt referred to the Revolutionary War. He said, in 1776, we sought freedom from the tyranny of a political autocracy, from the 18th century royalists who held special privileges from the crown. It was to perpetuate their privileges that they governed without the consent of the governed. And I'm going to repeat that again. They governed without the consent of the governed, that they denied the right of free assembly and of free speech, and they restricted the worship of God. So here's Democrat presidential candidate Franklin Roosevelt talking about the tyranny of these royalists who governed without the consent of the governed, and they restricted the worship of God. Well, that's exactly what we see happening today. For example, out in California, where the majority of the state voted to have marriage be one man and one woman, and four royalist judges with special privileges from the crown, these judges governed without the consent of the governed, and they denied the will of the people. And, you know, Lincoln, in his Gettysburg Address, asked the question at the end. It was his hope. He said that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth. So the idea was that we were a government that the laws reflected the views and beliefs of the people. And so when the will of the majority is reflected in the laws, then it's a democratic form of government. When the will of a minority is reflected in the laws, then it's a tyranny. And some of the interesting quotes, and I've read through just thousands of documents from the Founding Fathers.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, William was saying that certainly we have a rule by a very small minority, a small group of atheists and agnostics make up a little more than 1.5% of our society, and yet they're able to, by their manipulation, by certainly having their people planted in key positions in government, certainly be able to control the majority. And of course, when you have a minority, a small minority, controlling the majority, you have a tyranny. And he was pointing out, of course, here in California, where we had four judges who suddenly found that people who are homosexual and lesbians have a constitutional right to actually marry, irrespective of what the laws are that were voted on by the people here in California. Because here in California, where we had a referendum, it was found the overwhelming majority of the people said that marriage was something, an institution between a man and a woman. Now, certainly, if homosexuals want to live together, if they want to arrange their, you know, their lives so that when one dies, the other can inherit everything they have, and that's fine. I don't approve of it, but they have the right to do that. But why would they want to be married? Marriage has to do with a family, and they can't have families because, of course, they are practicing a perverted form of intimacy. So, but then, of course, William's point is very well taken. A very small majority of people are controlling what's going on in total violation of the concept that suddenly the majority rule. The Constitution, there's no place in the Constitution of the State of California or the Federal Constitution which gives the right of sodomy to anyone. And certainly when you're a sodomite, why, you really cannot marry. But anyway, go ahead, pick the story up there, Bill.
Well, it is interesting that gay marriage is not the end of their agenda, it's the beginning. They want to also lower the age of consensual sex. They want to get rid of the laws against polygamy. They want to get rid of laws against bestiality. They want to get rid of laws against incest. And so, again, what we see is just the beginning of the floodgates opening. It's not the end of their agenda. But nevertheless, talking about the will of the people, Alexander Hamilton, when New York was debating the ratification of the Constitution, he said, "The will of the people makes the essential principle of government." Thomas Jefferson in 1816 wrote, "Try every provision of our Constitution and see if it hangs directly on the will of the people." And then James Madison wrote, he says, "The past frequency of wars is traced to a will in the government independent of the will of the people." But we have to ask ourselves today, is the will of the people still reflected in the laws? Are the people still their own rulers? Well, if we go back in history and look at a similar time, the Supreme Court in 1857 passed the Dred Scott case. Dred Scott was a slave. He lived here in Missouri, the state that I'm in. I know his great-granddaughter, Lynn Jackson. But Dred Scott was a slave, and his master moved to Wisconsin, which was a free territory. And he lived there for several years, and lo and behold, there were other blacks that were up there in Wisconsin that were free. Anyway, his master moves back to Missouri and dies, and the widow was going to sell him and split the family, and so he had some friends that sued for his freedom, saying that since he lived on a free territory, that he could claim that he was a free individual. Well, it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Democrat Supreme Court Justice was Roger Taney, and the Dred Scott decision starts off with this noble statement saying all men are created equal, and it talks about these, you know, high things, but by the time it gets to the bottom of the decision, it says that slaves are so far inferior they should be enslaved for their own benefit. Talk about a racist decision. Well, Lincoln referenced and referred to this in his inaugural address, 1861. Lincoln said this: "The candid citizen must confess that if the policy of the government upon vital questions affecting the whole people is to be irrevocably fixed by the decisions of the Supreme Court the instant they are made, the people will have ceased to be their own rulers." And so that's what we see happening. The people have ceased to be their own rulers, and we have in its place this eminent tribunal, these four judges out in California, but nationally we see this happening over and over again. And, you know, people say, well, maybe that poll number was a little bit off. So I looked up just about every single poll I could find. But an interesting source that that all the polls agree within just a couple percentage points. But here's an interesting one. It's the CIA's website. Now, this is the Central Intelligence Agency of the U.S. government. And it's CIA.gov. And there's a link on there called World Fact Book. And you click on it, it lists every nation in the world and every imaginable statistic you want to know about that nation. It's great to help your kids with their homework. But you can click on Israel, and it says it's 80% Jewish. You click on Pakistan, it's 95% Muslim. You click on Saudi Arabia, it's 100% Muslim. That's because it's the death penalty if you're anything but. You click on Japan, it's 82% Buddhist. And India is 80-some-odd percent Hindu. Greece, 95% Eastern Orthodox. Poland, 95% Roman Catholic. Well, you click on the United States, and guess what our own CIA.gov website says? It says that close to 78% of Americans identify themselves as Christian. That breaks down to about 52% Protestant, about 24% Catholic, and a couple other percents for the other Christian, Eastern Orthodox, and so forth. And again, about 2% Jewish, 1% Muslim, 0.5% Hindu, 0.5% Buddhist, and only 1% atheist. This is our CIA's website saying 1% atheist, and close to 80% are holding Judeo-Christian values. And then we look at the ERISA, the American Religious Identification Survey. And I point this out that these are not done by Christian groups. The ERISA study was done by the City University of New York. And it reported that 52% of Americans are Protestant, 24.5% are Catholic, 1.3% are Jewish. And you add all that up, that comes up to 77.8% of the population holds Judeo-Christian values. Goes down further, a 0.5% Muslim, 0.5% Buddhist, 0.5% agnostic, 0.4% Hindu, 0.3% Unitarian Universalist, 0.1% Wiccan, Pagan, Druid, 6.3% spiritualist, Native American, Baha'i, New Age, Scientology, humanist, deist, so forth, and only 0.4% atheist. So if you look at all these polls together, you have anywhere from 0.4 to 1.6% are atheists, and between 77 to 80% hold Judeo-Christian values. Now this is down from what it used to be. In 1776, 98% of the country was Protestant, and a little less than 2% were Catholic, and 0.1% were Jewish. In the early 1800s, there was a Irish potato famine, and millions of Irish Catholics came to America, and the Catholic percent went from 2% to 20% in just a couple decades. And then there was the pogroms in Russia of the Jews in the late 1800s caused several million to come across, and that upped the Jewish percentage up to about 1% of the population. But we could look at other polls, Again, the Harris poll in 2003 said 90% of Americans believe in God. 90%. A Newsweek poll, 2007, said 91% of Americans believe in God. A Fox poll, 2004, said 92% of Americans believe in God. So again, here we are standing back from the forest so that we can, you know, sometimes people, they miss the forest for the trees. So we're going to stand back and look at this picture here. We've got close to 92% of the country believes in God, and 80% of those hold the Judeo-Christian view, but we only have 0.4 to 1.6% are atheists. How come that 1.6% gets to have their views be made the law of the land, and the 80% gets ignored? We see that we're transitioning from a democratic form of government where the laws reflect the views of the people, and we see it developing into a tyranny where the laws reflect the views of a minority. And, you know, when you look at it, the debate in America is really not over religion. It's not between the religious right and the liberal left. The debate in America is really between the will of the people and, as Washington warned in his farewell address, an artful and enterprising minority. Washington, in his farewell address, warned against an artful and enterprising minority. You know, if you have a majority of the people that have your views, you can operate through the democratic form of government. You can have elections. And if your candidate gets 80% of the vote, he gets in. But if you only have, if your views are held by a minority of the people, and you want to get them enforced into law, there's not enough people to vote for your views. So how do you do it? You get activist judges to change the definition of words that are in existing laws. And they do that over and over again. They twist the meanings and reinterpret the laws to simply push the agenda of this minority. So the struggle in America is between a constitutional republic with representatives elected by the people and the despotism of what Lincoln called an eminent tribunal. It's actually a battle between American democracy and tyranny. And so when we stand back and look at what's happening, instead of getting caught up with all the legal ways that they twist the words, we see that we're transitioning from a democratic form of government into a tyranny. We may as well be back in colonial times.
Well, I think it's important that people understand that there actually is a conspiracy against God. And of course, you read the Bible, you'll find many references to this conspiracy against God, but you see it been acted out and coming to fruition right here in our society. And so many of the decisions of the courts reflect the people who hate God and support their position against the will of the majority. Well, William, go right ahead.
Well, some of my favorite quotes are from President Ronald Reagan from California out there. And in 1984, Ronald Reagan said, "Sometimes I can't help but feel the First Amendment is being turned on its head. The First Amendment was not intended to protect the people from religion. The amendment was written to protect religion from government tyranny." Another place in 1983, in a press conference, Reagan said, "The First Amendment has been twisted to the point that freedom of religion is in danger of becoming freedom from religion." In 1982, to the Alabama State Legislature, Reagan said, "To those who cite the First Amendment as reason for excluding God, may I just say the First Amendment of the Constitution was not written to protect the people of this country from religious values. It was written to protect religious values from government tyranny." So we see that Reagan is basically saying that the First Amendment is being turned completely around. In a radio address, 1982, he said, "The Constitution was never meant to prevent people from praying. Its declared purpose was to protect their freedom to pray." And here they've twisted it around completely. One of my favorite quotes from Reagan is, he said this in 1982. He says, "In the last two decades, we've experienced an onslaught of such twisted logic that if Alice were visiting America, she might think she'd never left Wonderland. We're told, excuse me, we're told that it violates rights of others to permit students in school who desire to pray to do so. Clearly, this infringes on the freedom of those who choose to pray. To prevent those who believe in God from expressing their faith is an outrage. And again, this is Ronald Reagan. And but, you know, one of the things I think is important is to realize that atheism is a religion. It's a belief system. And so when you're kicking God out, you're not making it neutral. You're preferring a religion, and the religion is atheism. This is what Reagan said in 1984. He said, refusal to permit religious exercises is not seen as the realization of state neutrality, but rather the establishment of a religion of secularism. And so we see that the 1% of the country is forcing their religion. It may as well be the King of England forcing everybody to be Anglicans. But I was amazed at the cases. There was a case in 1957 called Washington Ethical Society versus the United States. And this ethical society wanted tax-exempt status as a religious organization. And the IRS said, no, you're an ethical society, you're not religious. Well, they sue, goes up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, ethical culture is a religion, they get tax-exempt status. And then, in 1960, there was a guy named Torcaso that wanted to be a notary, but he didn't want to say, so help me God, at the end of his state oath. Well, he was denied, but he appealed, and it went to the Supreme Court. And the activist judges said he could be a notary. And besides, there are now religions in the United States which do not acknowledge a supreme being, among them being secular humanism. So here we have a Supreme Court judge calling secular humanism a religion. And then in 1970, there was an atheist who wanted to be a draft dodger during the Vietnam War, and he wanted to claim religious conscientious objector status. Well, the lower court said you can't be a religious conscientious objector. You're an atheist. You're not religious.
Hold that thought, Bill, and we're going to be back here in just a moment with William Federer. Well, this is Dr. Stan. William is simply giving a few examples from history of the fact, to demonstrate the fact that secular humanism or even atheism is a religion. And this has actually been held over and over again by our Supreme Court, giving examples. He was talking about a draft dodger who was an atheist who wanted to get a religious exemption so he didn't have to serve in the military. Pick the story up there, William.
Well, and here's the Supreme Court deciding in the case of Welsh versus the United States, said that this person can be a draft dodger. He can claim religious conscientious objector status as an atheist because atheism is a religion. There was even a case 2 years ago in Wisconsin where a prisoner named Kaufman wanted to have a non-Bible study. He wanted a room and time off to have his little free thinker study. Well, he also wanted male pornography, and they wouldn't give it to him. Well, he sues, and it goes up to the federal court, and the federal judge says, in the case is called Kaufman versus McCautry, the federal judge says this, atheism is a religion. This person, Kaufman, gets to have their free thinker study. And I couldn't believe the court actually admitted it, but it goes on to say, originally, the First Amendment was simply intended to prevent the preference of one Christian denomination over another. But through the crucible of litigation, the courts have come to the unanimous conclusion that religion includes theism, atheism, and non-theism. I thought, wait a second, where does it mention crucible of litigation in the Constitution? It doesn't. I mean, if people want to change the Constitution, they pass amendments. Like the 13th Amendment outlawing slavery, the 14th Amendment giving rights to freed slaves, the 15th Amendment ending discrimination at the polling booths, and the 19th Amendment allowing women to vote, and the 22nd Amendment limiting a president to 2 terms. I mean, we know how to pass amendments, but here he admitted that they changed the Constitution through this quote-unquote crucible of litigation. The courts have usurped power from the other branches of government, from the people. And but it says, right in there, it says atheism is a religion. Theism and atheism and non-theism. And that's why I wrote a book, because the question is, if you can't have it both, in Greek, if you put A in front of a word, it means the opposite. So theism means God, atheism means no God. Gnostic means knowledge, agnostic means no knowledge. So you can't have two opposites. You can't be driving down the highway in forward and reverse at the same time. And so the question is, if we're going to have a belief system underlying the actions of the government, which one is better, to have an atheistic religion or a theistic religion? We're believing in a God. And when we go back and find out, well, gee, our founders said it was better to believe in God. That's why they wrote in the Declaration of Independence, all men are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. So it's this idea that your rights come from God, and the government's job is to protect those rights. Well, if there is no God, then where do your rights come from? Well, maybe the government. Well, it's interesting. John F. Kennedy, in his inaugural address, 1961, said the rights of man come not from the generosity of the state, but from the hand of God. Well, guess what? If there is no God, then the rights come from the generosity of the state, which makes the state the new God, and what the state giveth, the state can take it away. And that's what you have in totalitarian countries. So if you want to be an atheist and put your fist down on the table and says, I have rights the government can't take away, there's got to be a source for those rights higher than the government. And the founders and John F. Kennedy said it was God, the Creator. Matter of fact, Eisenhower, I love the quote, Eisenhower said, our founders had to refer to the Creator in order to make their revolutionary experiment make sense. In other words, how could we rebel against the King of England for taking away our rights? If he's the one that gave them to us, he can take them away. But if we claim that we have these rights from a source higher than the king, from a creator, and that the king is violating those rights, then we are justifying rebelling against that king. And so our founders had to refer to the creator in order to make our revolutionary experiment make sense. That was Dwight Eisenhower. So we see that you can't have it both ways. You can't have a nation under God and a nation not under God. And so the question is, which way is better? And all throughout our country's history, our government has said it was better to believe in God. I love what Eisenhower said in 1955. And believe it or not, Eisenhower sponsored a Back to God program with the American Legion. And we know Eisenhower is the one who put under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. But Eisenhower said, recognition of the Supreme Being is the first, the most basic expression of Americanism. In other words, you can't even be an American. The most basic expression of being an American is to acknowledge a Supreme Being. And here we have the federal courts wanting to outlaw that Supreme Being.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is William Federer. William just picked the story right up from there, and I think you're absolutely right. You can't have it both ways. If we want to maintain our freedom and the traditions of this country, they were originated with a belief in God, and once you destroy that belief, you destroy the country. And, of course, it's sort of like what we're doing today. There's an organized effort to do away with English as the official language of our country. In fact, when people have tried to get legislation through in Washington, D.C., English is the official language. It doesn't matter that certainly 95% of the people want it. Why they refuse to allow it? Why? Because, of course, this is how you disrupt a society. You take away the common language, you take away the common culture, you take away the common belief in God, and you finally end up with just a lot of people who are ruled by a very, very tiny minority, a tyranny of a group of people who have a different worldview. Go right ahead, William.
Well, you know, I like to say that multiculturalism is the AIDS virus of Western civilization. In other words, when we say that, all cultures are of equal value, then we will let in all these other beliefs, and we're basically allowing our Western culture and everything that came out of it to be destroyed. When I speak in schools, I'll ask questions, and I'll ask, do all cultures value human life equally? And the kids will sit there for a minute, and then they'll say, well, no. And sure enough, other cultures have lower values for human life. I did an interview with the Washington Post, and the reporter asked if I was, I had done some congressional staff briefings in the U.S. Capitol, speaking with staffers for different congressmen and senators, and one gentleman was there from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and so this reporter said, well, gee, was I trying to push Christianity on our country? And I asked the reporter a question. I said, do you like being equal? And the reporter said, well, yeah. I says, well, guess what? That is a Judeo-Christian idea. I said, equality did not come from Islam, because in Islam, a woman is not equal to a man. It takes two women to testify in court against one man. A woman gets half the inheritance that a man gets. They even have a thing called blood money, where if you were to kill somebody, you pay their family a fine, and blood money for a woman is half of the blood money for a man. Blood money for an infidel is half of the blood money for a Muslim. So if you are a Christian woman, you are literally a half of a half. They put a dollar price tag on you. And so equality did not originate in that belief system.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment with our good friend William Federer. Well, William, go right ahead. And, of course, you were actually mentioning you had you were actually testified or actually given briefings there in Washington, D.C. to a number of people in key positions. And you were accosted by a reporter from the Washington Post who accused you or asked you if you were trying to force Christian beliefs on the people in government or court. Force Christian beliefs on our society, and you asked him if he believed in equality. What was his response after that?
Well, I went on. I said, now, equality did not originate in Hinduism, because in Hinduism, where they believe in reincarnation, they say there are seven major castes that somebody can be reincarnated into, the lowest being the untouchables, called the Dalits. And the untouchables are considered less than human. They have to live outside of town. They have to clean the toilets and take care of the garbage. And the other castes cannot even touch them, because if they do, they'll get reincarnated lower the next time around because they're so dirty. Anyway, the untouchable is not equal to the Brahmin. The Brahmin are the highest caste. That they're near divinity, you know. So equality did not originate in the Hindu belief system. And equality did not originate in atheism. We can look at the former USSR, where there, and in China, your worth is dependent on your utility. If you can contribute to the state, you're worth something. If you cannot contribute to the state, you're a leech. You're voted off the island. You're a useless eater, you know. That's what we have with our survivor programs, where we try to condition people in America for that your worth is dependent on your utility. Well, in America, you're not equal based on being a Muslim male. You're not equal because you're a Brahmin in the highest caste. You're not equal because you're useful to the state. You're equal why? Well, Democrat President Harry S. Truman, and I bring that out because, you know, just 50 years ago, we had Democrat presidents that were promoting God. FDR actually passed out New Testaments to all the soldiers in World War II. But Harry S. Truman, in his inaugural address, said, we believe all men are created equal because we're created in the image of God. Question, what belief system believes you're made in the image of God? Jews and Christians, Book of Genesis, in the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. In Islam, Muhammad said, Allah has no image. In Hinduism, there are 300 million different gods, so which one would you be made in the image of? And in atheism, there is no God to be made in the image of. So the very basic idea that Harry S. Truman said, we believe all men are created equal because we're created in the image of God, that is a Judeo-Christian concept. So if you want to keep the table standing, you got to keep the legs in place. If you want to keep equality in the country, you've got to keep the beliefs that gave birth to that. And it wasn't atheism, it wasn't Hinduism, it wasn't Islam, it wasn't multiculturalism, it was the Judeo-Christian concepts. And so I think that's so important. I mean, even the Jewish idea of an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, what that says is the punishment fits the crime, and that the value of your life is worth the value of somebody else's life. Where in Islam, Muhammad said, no Muslim shall be killed for killing a kafir, an infidel. So it establishes that the life of an infidel is less than the value of the life of a Muslim. Muhammad said to cut off the hand of a thief. So the punishment does not fit the crime. The punishment is a whole lot more than the crime. There is not the concept of equality there. And so, again, the country that we have, the laws that we have, the very underlying structure of equality is based on a Judeo-Christian thought. It doesn't mean everybody in the country has to be a Jew or a Christian, and it doesn't mean that all the Jews and the Christians have lived perfect lives, but it does mean that these concepts we have a basis in biblical thought, and if we want to keep those concepts, we got to keep the foundation that gave birth to them.
Amen to that. Well, I certainly what did the fellow from the Washington Post say when you got all done explaining it to him?
Well, the group that I was doing the speaking for was D. James Kennedy had started the Center for Christian Statesmanship up there, and they had been contacting them for months trying to basically do a hatchet job. And I was instructing them from what I had learned from running for politics that sometimes when you know that they're fishing for something, the best thing you can do is to not give them any sound bites. So I basically spiked their story. I didn't come across as a Bible thumping, yeah, I want to convert everybody up there. I appealed to common sense, and anyway, they did not write the story that they were going to, and so that was great for the ministry to continue ministering.
Okay, fine. Well, I'm sure that you did an excellent job, but people have to really understand that there is an organized, orchestrated effort to destroy the very foundation, the legs of that stool that you were talking about, upon which this nation rests. Destroy belief in God and in family, and the righteousness of our nation, destroy the language of our nation, destroy the culture of our nation, and you don't have much left, do you?
Well, you don't. And you know, while I'm on the subject, the title of my book is Three Secular Reasons Why America Should Be Under God. And the third reason is interesting. It says, do you like a country that has few laws? Well, you think about it, yeah, we don't want the government telling us what to do every moment of every day. We'd rather have few laws. Well, in order for there to be order in society with few external laws, the populace needs to have internal moral laws. So like a scale, the more internal laws the populace has, the less external laws they need. But we've been stripping away the internal laws and telling people, give into your passions, give into your lusts, do whatever you want, and they've been doing it. And all these crimes happen as a result. And then people say, government, do something about all these crimes. And the only thing the government knows how to do is pass laws. And so every new law that is passed is another bar that comes down on our cage, taking away our freedom. And so our founders had this idea that if the people could govern themselves internally, morally, we could get by with fewer external laws. As a matter of fact, John Adams was so proud of this concept that when he wrote the Constitution for Massachusetts, which, by the way, is the oldest constitution in the world still in use. It predates our U.S. Constitution by 7 years. It was written in 1780, and it's still being used today. Anyway, John Adams, obviously they've made changes to it, but John Adams put in there a provision that said the state shall lay a tax so that there may be Protestant teachers of piety and religion to be supported and go across the state for every community and so forth. And he was proud of this. Why? Because he understood that for there to be a free government with few external laws, the populace needed to have inculcated in them these moral principles, these moral laws. And I love what the one English, Edmund Burke, he was the member of parliament who actually supported the colonies. Most people are familiar with Edmund Burke because he said the only thing necessary for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. And Edmund Burke said that all men must be controlled in one way or the other. And the less they have of stringent state government, the more they must have of private moral judgment. And it says, men of intemperate minds cannot be free. Their passions forge their fetters or their shackles. Another interesting person is Robert Winthrop. He was the Speaker of the House in 1849. And Robert Winthrop said this, men must be controlled, either by a power within them or a power without them, either by the word of God or the strong arm of man, either by the Bible or the bayonet. He said, it may do for other countries to have the state support religion. In America, with our free institutions, it's religion which must support the state. It's religion which must produce a moral populace from which can be drawn leaders. It's like if the bucket of water is pure, you can take the dipper and pull it out, and you can have a clean glass of water. If the populace has internal morals, then you can raise people up into leadership, and they will too will have morals. But what we've done is we've been stripping away the internal laws. We've been taking the Ten Commandments off of the schoolroom walls, and now we have to put metal detectors on the schoolroom doors. We've been taken away, thou shalt not kill, because man's made in the image of God. And instead, in the public schools, they teach situation ethics, where they tell little Johnny, if there's too many people in a lifeboat, he has to decide which one's useless and shove him over the side. And then we get shocked when little Johnny gets out into his neighborhood and decides some kid's useless and blows him away. And, you know, that we're shocked he acted out the philosophy he was taught in the classroom rather than the good old-fashioned, thou shalt not kill, because man's made in the image of God.
Well, you know, I'm always remembered what John Adams said about, our form of government was made for a moral and religious people. It would not work for any other. And what he was basically saying, of course, was that, you know, as long as we had people who were moral, who could govern themselves according to God's law, then we could be free. We could limit the power of government. But, of course, that system would not work if we did not have moral and religious people. And I think that's such an important message for every listener to know. Now, you've written a new book. I hadn't heard about it. You haven't sent me a copy. I guess it sounds like something that we would want to carry. Tell me a little bit about this book. Is it just off the press? How long has it been out? And does it cover the things that you've been covering tonight?
Yeah, the three secular reasons why America should be under God. It's been out a while, but I recently re-edited it and added a lot more to it. In the back of the book, it has all 50 state constitutions where they've mentioned God, and where every one of the 43 presidents mentioned God in their inaugural address or in their address upon assuming office, because nine of them did not give inaugural addresses. You only give an inaugural address when you're actually elected. And so nine presidents became, four presidents took the office when the previous president died in office. Four presidents took office when the previous president was assassinated. And one, Gerald Ford, took office when the previous president resigned, Nixon. And so they didn't give inaugurals. And so what I did in my book is I gave their first address. But every one of these presidents mentioned God in their first address upon taking office. Again, just to highlight the fact that we are a country that does believe in God. Matter of fact, the oath to become a U.S. senator or congressman ends with, so help me God. That's in the U.S. Code. The oath to be a federal judge ends with, so help me God. That's in the U.S. Code. The oath to be a military officer or an enlisted man ends with, so help me God. The oath to give a testimony in a federal court ends with, so help me God. The question is, why God? Why is it important for our government to have these leaders acknowledge God? Well, our founders did that on purpose. They understood that being in positions of leadership, you would have the opportunity to do dirty backroom deals and never ever get caught. But if they believed that, if they were confident that if you believed in God and that God was looking over your shoulder when you were in that back room and you're about to do this dirty deal, you'd say, boy, I can get away with this, and then you'd hesitate. And you think, you know, I could get away with this my whole life and nobody would ever find out, but I'd have to face God in the next life and be called on the carpet for it. And it causes you to hesitate, causes you to have this thing called a conscience. And so you end up not doing the wrong because of the idea of having a consequence. Daniel Webster was a senator from Massachusetts. He was a Secretary of State for three U.S. presidents. And Daniel Webster was once asked, when he was an old man, what the most profound thought was that ever went through his mind. And his response was, my accountability to God. So it's this idea that all day long, no matter what he did, he kept thinking, I'm going to be held accountable for this. What does it cause you to do? It causes you to be nice to everybody. It causes you to want to be with honest and do what's right. And if you don't believe there's a God, then it's like, I do whatever I want. And then the next step is maybe you do believe in God, but your concept of God is one that he wants you to murder people. And so when we look at Western civilization, we see, for example, in Europe, where they've gone from drive into neutral before they go into reverse. Europe, at one point, was all Catholic, and then the Protestant Reformation always had a remnant of Jews, but it was all Judeo-Christian. And they had this concept, they didn't always live up to it, but it was there bothering their conscience, that be nice to the stranger because you were once a stranger in Egypt. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But then Europe went into neutral with the French Revolution, which gave birth to deism and secularism and atheism, which gave birth to the pluralism and multiculturalism and diversity that said, oh, bring in whatever beliefs you want. There's nothing special about that Judeo-Christian stuff. And so all these other beliefs start flooding into Europe, and then finally comes in Sharia law Islam. And it slams the car into reverse and says there's Allah up there that you're accountable to, but he wants you to be ruthless to the infidel. He wants you to kill the kafir. He wants you to, he sanctions beating your wife if she disobeys you. The Sharia law says it's okay to kill your daughter if she dishonors the family by dating a non-Muslim. The fundamental Muslim, the Sharia law Islam, they do these things, because their view of accountability to their Allah in the next life is one where Allah expects them to be trying to make the world submit to Allah, to wanting to do these military conquests and so forth. So we've gone from drive into neutral, and now we're being thrown into reverse. I tell people, I said, atheism is just a temporary state. The whole atheistic gay agenda, secularism, it's just a temporary state. All it is the neutral, shifting from a Judeo-Christian culture into secular before it goes into reverse. That John Lennon song, Imagine there's no heaven, imagine this and that and this and that. But then he says, nothing to live and die for. You say, wait a second, nothing to live and die. Yeah, if there is no God, and there's no accountability, and there's no country, there's no values to preserve because you've embraced multiculturalism, there's nothing, then there's nothing to live and die for. In other words, that once you become a secular atheistic society, you've removed all motivation to defend it. And so then the radical Islam can come in, and they do not assimilate, and they do want to take over, and they'll use whatever means necessary. And so basically, secularism is Roundup. You spray it on your lawn, it kills everything, including the good grass, but then your lawn's just dirt, and then any seed, a weed, that happens to blow in the wind, or some bird drops it, your lawn will be filled full of weeds. And so when you turn from a Judeo-Christian culture into this secular atheistic gay agenda culture, it's just a temporary state because in's going to come the Sharia law Islam. Nobody's going to defend the pluralism. I mean, here's a gun. Go out and give your life for multiculturalism. It's like, why am I out here fighting?
Well, we're almost out of time. I want you to get out your website, your telephone number right now before we run out of time. I think it's so important people have access to your material. Go ahead.
Well, the website is AmericanMinute.com, AmericanMinute.com, and you can buy all my books on there, and you can also sign up for my free daily email called The American Minute. It's a short little historical vignette of something that happened on each date in American history. And then I have a toll-free telephone number. It's 1-888-USA-WORD, 1-888-USA-WORD.
All right, fine. Well, Gersten, we actually carry a number of your books right now. Of course, we still get America's God and Country, and of course, the book that you wrote on St. Nicholas and on St. Patrick, and an awful lot of books. And we just think that you've contributed so much to our enlightenment and the enlightenment of our listeners, and we'll certainly want to very seriously consider carrying these three secular reasons why America should be under God. You don't really go into that article you wrote on for WorldNet Daily in that book, do you? Is that separate?
I touch on it a little bit, but I don't expand quite as much as I do in the article.
All right, fine. Chris, is that article still up on WorldNet Daily?
Yeah. If you do a little search on Federer, put in my name, or the title of the article is Tyranny of the Atheist Minority.
Tyranny of the Atheist Minority, okay.
And But those that are in the listening audience, if you're going to buy the book, I encourage you to buy it from Dr. Stan, because I support all that you're doing and just think that the country needs you, and just appreciate you so much.
Well, we're just fortunate to have a voice, and of course we appreciate everything that you do as well. And are you going to be running for political office again? What do you think?
Not making any plans to now, just because I'm so busy. I spoke in over 80 cities last year and did about 400 radio interviews, and been doing TV and so forth. So I guess as long as I'm keeping busy, and I sort of feel like I'm a former congressman without having been one, because most of the former congressmen I know, they're trying to write books and get out and speak. So
and you don't even have to go to Congress. You can still write books and go out and speak. So
I had lunch with Rick Santorum about 2 months ago, and he said that politics is downstream from culture. And so he's understanding. Matter of fact, he's helping to be a consultant on 3 movies to expose radical Islam, and they should be coming out this fall. And one of them is a humorous one, and they have Chris Farley's brother is acting, and it's I saw a little clip of it, and it's hilarious. But anyway, here he is wanting to influence the culture, realizing that that politics is just downstream from the culture, and you influence the culture through media and through education. And Dr. Stan, that's what you're doing. You're taking advantage of the media and educating people to the truth.
Amen to that. Well, anyway, of course, our guest this evening has been William Federer, and of course, it's theamericanminute.com, theamericanminute.com. Thank you for everything you do, Bill. We'll look forward to having you on some of our other programs real soon.
Oh, well, God bless you, Dr. Stan, and my best regards to Barbara.
Righto. Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, I hope you enjoyed the program this evening, ladies and gentlemen, because Sidney William is certainly one of the clearest thinkers we have on our side, and I find it a real privilege to be able to refer to him as a friend. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course we hope that many of you will want to get that book. We will be getting that as soon as we have an opportunity to, but right now we carry William Federer's book, America's God and Country. We carry his book on St. Patrick, on St. Nicholas, and on certainly a number of others. You can certainly go to our website and look under his name and see all the books that he's written. And of course, they're all inspirational. And of course, they're all centered with this realization that we are dependent upon God. In fact, if there's no God, life really is hopeless. You simply live 70 years and then you die. No good deed ever goes unpunished. No, there is a God, and this is really what makes life worth living. In fact, the longer I live, the more convinced I am that God does rule in the affairs of men. And we are seeing the playing out of his prophecies today as we see a move towards pestilence. In other words, new diseases forming, a move towards famine. I believe there are food riots all over the world today. And then war, and of course, we are certainly facing an expansion of the war in the Middle East. And I hope and pray that I'm wrong, but everything makes me believe that we are going to go to war with Iran and Syria before the year is out. Pray that I'm wrong. Well, this is the time I want to mention that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. We're dependent upon those of you who listen to our programs to help us, and right now things are a little tight. We could certainly use your support if you're in a position to help. Then, of course, we hope that you'll get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. because why did they take God and prayer out of our schools? Well, nobody's ever going to tell you why the Supreme Court in 1962 took God and prayer out of our schools, but you'll find the truth in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and what motivated the Supreme Court justices. Why did they do what they did? Because they had to know that down the line it would lead to the destruction of the very fabric of our society. And I would like to suggest that they knew exactly what they were doing. They just could not let the American people know the truth. And the churches of our country and the ministers will not tell you why the Supreme Court took God and prayer out of our schools. But you'll find the story in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. And then, of course, I certainly hope that you want to get our talk on the Forbidden Secret, the Forbidden Secret. You hope that you want to get our 4-tape set on the execution of Martin Luther King and the book that goes with that, An Act of State, because, of course, the 4-tape set will tell you that it was a federal hit. Certainly, probably CIA employed the mafia to carry out the assassination of Martin Luther King, and everything was done to cover up the government's involvement. And then, of course, if you'd like to know what really happened at Waco, and how a group of special forces men were sent in to kill the women and the children. That's right. And you'll actually hear the testimony of several people who talked to members of the special forces who readily admitted they were sent in to kill the women and the children. The DVD is called Waco, A New Revelation. You need to get it. Once you understand what happened at Waco, you can understand what really happened, certainly at the Burr Building in Oklahoma City, and then you can begin to understand how it was that the Twin Towers came down looking just like a controlled demolition, why Building 7 came down looking like a controlled demolition, why the crash site at Shanksville